You know, I've never met anyone like you in Washington before.
Yes, I've been here all my life.
Really? And where have you been all my life? Tell me, Mr. Gardner, have you ever had sex with a man?
No, I don't think so.
We could go upstairs right now.
Is there a TV upstairs? I like to watch.
You like to watch?
Yes.
You wait right here. I'll go get Warren.
Episode 58 of the Cult of Matt and Mark, Cult Film Review Podcast. I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
And make sure to hit our website at cultfilmreview.blogspot.com or shoot us an email at cultfilmreview@gmail.com or don't call us because we don't have a phone number yet.
No, we don't have a phone number yet. But like, you can send us an email. Didn't we get an email the other day from a fan?
Yes, we did.
I was looking over it. I think I'm has a couple interesting movies on that list.
Richard Blake. I can't find his email off my computer just yet, but yeah, no, he had some kind words and gave us some movie recs.
He had an interesting early film from Australia starring what's that guy's name?
Russell Crowe.
You know, wasn't on Netflix. I might have to go over to Scarecrow Crow Video to hunt it down.
Romper Stomper.
It looked really interesting.
He's like an Australian skinhead.
Yeah, I'll let you know if I find it at the at Scarecrow, and I'll let you know.
What I say about the Australians? I say a lot about them.
Are they really racist or something? I don't know. What are you going to say?
I say the Australia is the only other place in the world that has quality rednecks like the United States.
You know, they do. It's sort of the good sense of redneck.
Really? Like, I don't know. They're pretty racist, man. I don't know.
There's part of that I enjoy. It's a sort of national identity. Sort of like the gun-toting identity of the U.S.
Shitting over all your minorities.
Yeah, and just being, but a lot of times, a lot of things that come with the redneck community, I think, are important, like importance of family.
Fighting in pointless wars like Vietnam and
Iraq.
Yeah,
stuff like that. I don't know. Yeah, it's got some good and it's got some bad, but it's what you are. Sometimes
well, they do like muscle cars, without muscle cars, we wouldn't have Mad Max.
And how about beer? They love beer.
They like beer.
I like beer, too.
I can't get that accent all wrong. I'm not going to even try it. Okay. But anyway, yeah, good Rex. And The Thing was on there. And
yeah, The Thing, when one of us finally pulls the trigger on doing a director more than once. It just seems like there's still directors. Like today, here's a director we hadn't seen, Hal Ashby.
I'd like to get to, like, Francis Ford Coppola. I'd like to get to, Quentin Tarantino.
See, there's still all these outstanding directors. I feel funny going back and seeing directors again. You know, sure, it'd be fun for us just to do all the, do The Thing, all the John Carpenter's work. I mean, there's so many. They Live. I'd love to do They Live.
Yeah.
We will, but God, it seems like I really should. I still got, already got DVDs ripped of five more other seminal directors from film history.
It's a little touched yet. Masturbatory, I think,
To just play
camp now, on one director.
In a certain extent, I see some movie podcasts, they do that. And I think it works because you really get in a groove. And I think especially because your knowledge of that director's work is a lot deeper because you've watched a film seriously and then you've spent some time thinking about it, and then you spent some time talking about it seriously. I think sometimes the conversations get deeper and deeper. It just, and maybe it'd be good for us to do it, but there's still so many directors out there.
Maybe I'll pull the trigger. Maybe I'll just violate that taboo right on you.
Yeah, that's fine. I thought you'd probably be the first to pull the trigger.
Oh yeah. You know me.
You got a hair trigger or something?
No, I just, I don't know what the fuck I was getting at. All right. This week's film is the 1979 classic. I don't know if it's necessarily a cult film, but it's definitely high on the chart for quintessential movies of its kind. Being There, released in 1979. Did I already say that?
No, we haven't done any of the history yet.
All right. Starring Peter Sellers, I think his second to last film. It's directed by Hal Ashby and based on a novel by Jerzy Kaczynski and written, I think the screenplay was written.
Yeah, this is the only, as far as I can tell, this is the only screenplay Kaczynski?
Kaczynski, yeah.
Ever did.
Polish-American novelist.
And it's a pretty impressive screenplay.
So let me get to the plot rundown. And again, this one's a little long, but, you know, just if you need to chime in, chime in. If you don't, don't. Whatever you want to do. Having lived his life as the gardener on a millionaire's estate, Chance, played by Peter Sellers, knows of the real world only what he has seen on TV. When his benefactor dies, Chance walks aimlessly into the streets of Washington, D.C., where he is struck by a car owned by wealthy Eve Rand, played by Shirley MacLaine. Identifying himself, the confused man mutters, "Chance Gardner," which Eve takes to be Chauncey Gardner. Eve takes him to her home to convalescence, and because Chance is so well-dressed and well-groomed, and because he speaks in such a cultural tone, everyone in her orbit assumes that Chauncey Gardner must be a man of profound intelligence. No matter what he says, it is interpreted as a pearl of wisdom and insight. He rises to the top of Washington society, where his simplistic responses to the most difficult questions, responses usually related to his gardening experience, are highly prized by the town's movers and shakers. In fact, there's a serious consideration given to running Chance as a presidential candidate. Both a modern fable and a political satire, being there was based on the novel by Jerzy Kaczynski. And that's pretty much it. And it yielded quite a few Oscar nods and wins.
Yeah, for best supporting actor, for the guy who plays Ed, the old man, Ed Rand.
Yeah.
Not the old man. There's another character.
That's right. The old man is just referenced as the old man. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You see him once in his sort of death face. Pretty impressive. Very realistic sort of presentation of a dead person.
Here we have a case as Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Tropic Thunder would refer to as half retard, as opposed to the full retard.
Yeah, he didn't go full retard, and I think that's really important, especially considering where the film really goes, which is all the way.
All the way. But yeah, and I don't know if he mentions it in Tropic Thunder about being there, but he goes through like a list of half retard roles, like Rain Man.
Oh, he does. I wonder if he does mention Peter
Forrest
Sellers.
Gump. And then he talks, I think, about, who is it, Sean Penn's role as I Am Sam, which is the full retard.
Full retard, yeah.
Right, so there's a big difference.
There's no Oscar nomination there.
And Ben Stiller's character who plays Simple Simon. I think it was Simple Simon.
Yeah, Simple Simon with the fake teeth.
Yeah, it goes the full retard.
God, that was a really good movie. I really enjoyed Tropic Thunder.
So,
It is sort of haunting, and the way that Peter Sellers doesn't break character. It's a strange character where this is the weirdest comedy I've ever seen in my life.
Can I be honest? I don't think I enjoyed this movie as much as you did.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I was profoundly touched by this.
My well has been poisoned by Forrest Gump, which you could almost argue is sort of a feel-good ripoff of Being There.
It really is a feel-good ripoff.
And that sort of ruined it. And it's not the movie's fault, which is sort of disappointing. It's what came after and what was borrowed from it, and poorly borrowed. Because Forrest Gump, I don't know what the fucking point of that movie is. It has some sort of Zemeckis
feel-good movie.
Yeah.
You sit back and you feel good, like reading a summer read. You just let it wash over you, and you see all the shrimp boating and the jogging and the ping-pong playing and the ice cream.
Cat and Dan's Redemption.
And the president. And I mean, look, I like Forrest Gump. I mean, that's the 3 hours that fly right by. I've seen it like three times.
You can camp out on it.
I mean, it's one of my favorite, whatever the actor's name is, movie. I mean, I like Tom Hanks. You know, I'm terrible with names, as everybody who's listened to more than three episodes know that. But Tom Hanks, the only movie I like more is another schmaltzy movie he has, Apollo 13, though, but different director.
My wife directing it. Hates Tom Hanks. Yeah, I guess it's
really,
like,
he's pretty funny in interviews.
It's I mean, it's a pointless argument.
Performances, or do you hate
He just thinks, like, since he's gotten a little bit of carb face, he's too jolly. He kind of has some of the same.
What you do
same.
Is you just move right over to Colin Hanks. He's got all the sexy youngness that Tom used to have.
And he has that sort of, there's like, it's like his pee face. Like, he pees. Like, there's some, for some reason, there's some meme with Tom Hanks peeing or has to pee in all of his movies.
I mean, Castaway is a great performance. I think he's a really good actor.
He's a great actor.
I mean, and that's not even touching on Bosom Buddies.
Splash.
Or the Money Sink. Or what was that called?
Bachelor Party. I mean, come on. It's just so many.
Big.
Oh, fucking Big. All right. See,
he's the national treasure. You shut your mouth.
He's the Jimmy Stewart of our age. Anyway, so.
It is. I guess it is. I mean, the thing. I don't know what. I'm really confused about what direction we're going to attack this movie at. But I'll tell you one thing. This is one of those movies, and I've never seen it from a comedy, that makes me profoundly uncomfortable. Profoundly. I was just incredible. I was standing up and pacing around watching this movie. I was so
uncomfortable. Why was it? Well, okay, like that scene that you introduced with.
No, that was one of the more blatantly funny scenes.
You know what I was wondering? Did he actually go off and watch two guys hammer each other?
You know, the truth is we don't know.
Because I would think that would affect somebody, no matter how half retard they are.
The movie uses cuts a lot in this film. And if you watch it on one level, when it cuts, you can just assume that things were resolved in the simplest fashion. But there's no reason you need to assume that. And, I mean, that's one important, and the sort of the interpretation I take from the film. But let's just leave that alone just for a second.
Okay.
I want to talk more about the mood it evoked in me. I mean, I've seen movies that really make me tense, and I've only seen it from suspenseful films. Two that come to mind are Mamet's House of Games.
Yeah, you really like that film.
I mean, it's one of those movies that really is very similar in that I just couldn't sit still. In fact, I had to pause this movie at some points just to settle down.
What points did you have problems with?
The other movie is The Conversation.
Oh, really?
It's one of these movies that builds up tension, and then you're at the edge of your seat waiting for the tension to be broken, and then somehow it's deflated.
Give me an example. I need an example.
I mean, from this film?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, all the situations where you can't believe somebody's not going to call them on it.
Well, okay. To me, and maybe this is part of the problem I had with this film, and it's odd me having a problem. It's like a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. Everybody loves it.
Well, these classic films get inflated ratings.
It failed the believability. It was, I was sitting there going, come on.
Well, near the end, like when he goes on the talk show, and he sort of sounds like an idiot, but people take him seriously. Even the people you've seen before, like the president, who doesn't seem like a stupid man, still are mesmerized by him. When he goes to the dinner party and he's interviewed by the reporters, and somehow they believe the fact that he says he doesn't read newspapers, and he sends it the most simple way: I do not read newspapers. I like to watch TV. That's all he says.
That's like Sarah Palin.
They assume that he says, well, he gets his news from new media, and he can. Yeah. The old stodgy media can go hang, in his opinion.
Well, that's the obviously sort of the.
It really stretches credulity. Is that a word? Credulity.
Oh man, now you fucked me up. Credibility.
Yeah, it really stretches. And be quite honest with you, it overstretches it, especially near the end. It really ramps it up, like when he's talking to the Russian diplomat, or when he's talking to this gay guy at this party. These tension building things come up over and over again, where you can't believe there's any way somebody's going to misinterpret what's happening and see that, don't not see him as an idiot.
Well,
is that
my problem, because and I had to view this movie as a satire, and so when things are in that satirical realm, you can easily buy the point it's trying to make. I get it. There's implausibilities all throughout this film, and I was trying to tune that out and just kind of watch the allegory, or I guess the not the allegory, the comment that Kaczynski was trying to make on American media and society. But he would run across somebody who has a little bit of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Nobody can be that incurious, and especially, the people that he runs into, who are people of power, and that's their whole ball game, is manipulating people to achieve power, and they would have more insight into an individual.
They would see an idiot for an idiot, or a child, man-child for a man-child.
They would be a little bit more inquisitive. You know, if some guy was toast to the town and I had 5 minutes alone with him, I would, you know, you could kind of do a cold read. You could definitely get more out of it. You figure he's an idiot.
Okay, tell me your, give me the 5 minute synopsis of your life.
Yeah, or like, what do you do for a living?
Where do you go to school?
I'm a gardener. You know, yeah.
Do you go to Yale or do you go to Harvard?
See, that would be weeded out. I'm sorry. But I get it. And for the sake of the movie, I went along with all of it. And
but see, the thing, I know what you're saying, but I just want to say that every time you meet somebody, I would feel this intense tension about the sort of credibility of the situation would get stressed so much. It would stress me out along with it. And the sort of constantly meeting new people and every new situation, you go, there's no way that these people could misinterpret his simplistic discussion about gardening as some deep insight into how the world works. You see what I mean?
No, I see what you mean.
And that tension over and over again really just, it just reached inside of me okay. and really grabbed me. And I could just feel that tension. It really had me by the balls.
Okay.
And that's why I like this film, because it had me by the balls.
I just couldn't buy it. And so from that point of view, I was kind of, I guess, more curious about what the people would do to convince themselves that this guy knew what he was talking about.
You know, and I think that I'd probably have a similar thing. I was certainly thinking that near the end, where the situation where he becomes more of a public figure, the TV, the dinner party, the funeral, and I start to go, God, it's just, I understand the tension, I enjoy that, but it's just, it's beyond fanciful.
It's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And it got to the point where, God, this is really, now, if the movie hadn't summed up the way it did, I'd probably have that criticism. If, like, in the end, he had been found out, or if he hadn't been found out, how would that change your... If in the end, there was finally attention broke and they understood he was a man-child and everybody realized it and it resolved its way. It could resolve happily or sadly for chance. But then you'd go, God, well, then these situations were supposed to be real. It means that at any time, these people could have found out he was a real person. So they're really stretching it too far if it existed in the real world.
Of course.
And I think I'd have that same problem.
Yeah.
But that's not how the movie resolves itself. And so it sort of basically what it does is it pulls the rug out from under that argument at the end.
Well, it resolves itself with mock allegorical, I'm using that word correctly now, moment with him walking on water, which is just silly. I mean,
oh, see, I knew we're gonna have a deep schism.
No, it's not. There's
to
be honest,
deep schism.
No, the filmmaker didn't intend to have that in the end. It was just seemed like that would look good, and it would.
I heard that was the case, but
yeah, which is fine. I mean, it kind of adds a nice coda, a weird little coda to the film, and kind of gives it more of a. It reinforced the fact that I found the whole setup of the movie implausible. It's like, oh yeah, he's walking on water. Okay, because this movie is not real.
We have a deep schism then in our interpretation of the movie. I don't agree with the, and I read that online. I don't agree with the director's interpretation.
How can you not?
I know,
disagree
isn't that amazing?
With the director's interpretation.
I see this
of his
as
film.
A supernatural tale, almost a piece of science fiction. This movie.
Well. I mean, science, it's a piece of satire. And satire is an exaggeration of the truth. And you get exaggeration of the truth in this all over the place.
I mean, the way it stretches
credibility. Well, of course. Well, what it's doing is it's commenting on the political and media establishment of the United States. That people, it's reaffirming your cynicism that people in power don't know what the fuck they're talking about and don't know what they're doing and are reaching for anything worth any kind of integrity. And that's exactly what you get here. He just spouts off like, you know, he's a broken clock. That's right twice a day, you know? And so
that's a great one.
And so with the whole, you know, presidential advisory thing where he just mentions some gardening thing,
something about the seasons. Cycles of life.
Oh, shit, man. You could chalk up everything to a cycle. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's ups and downs. Life's as full as ups and downs. I mean, that's all he says, you know, except for he kind of says it in a sort of quixotic, you know, Stan Laurel cadence that seems a little bit more well thought out than, you know, some yokel who would spout such nonsense.
Now I see, God, it's just such a boring explanation.
What else? I mean, to me, what I don't know. Yeah, and the problem is maybe the film is a little dated. And
well, it's dated in the sense that it's slower than modern films.
No, I mean dated as, okay, so if you had Chauncey now, or Chance, or whatever, would it be television, or would it be the internet? Would he be like a World of Warcraft nerd, and everything he knows about the universe is through playing World of Warcraft?
Well, you know, the weird thing about Chance being an idiot is he's not really an idiot on certain levels.
Well, when I watched it, if you were to diagnose the character,
yeah,
I would say he's highly functioning
autistic,
marginal Asperger's. Obviously, he's focused on gardening and assumes everybody else is, which is typically an Asperger's trait.
He has a deep understanding for gardeners.
Well,
for gardening.
Yeah, so Asperger's people have a deep understanding of computer software and computer code, but they don't have any kind of insight into empathy or shared experience. And neither does Chauncey. He has no clue, which seems odd because his whole thing is TV.
Yeah, what about all the TV? TV is so important in this film.
And
there's so many cuts of TV on the film itself. Close up, just they filmed the television screen.
Basketball Jones.
Oh, the Basketball Jones.
Basketball
just
Jones.
Blew my mind.
That's, you know, it's an old Cheech and Chong song bit from one of their live albums,
yeah,
from one of their comedy albums back in the day.
It.
And watching it now, I've seen that. I don't know where or when, maybe on a Cheech and Chong movie back when I was a kid. I don't know what the fuck I was doing watching Cheech and Chong as a kid. God, my parents. Jesus Christ. Anyway, watching that cartoon, it's like so racist. Like,
I mean, how is it racist?
Just the depiction.
Those are some hot, curvy black women.
Oh, the depiction, like the sort of...
I like the tight sweater they're wearing, all nipping out.
They look like little Sambos.
You see the underwear on them as for days of the week.
Like Basketball Jones looked like a Sambo.
Yeah, he did. Well, he looked like he was from Fat Albert cartoon.
Oh,
he like
Fat Albert.
Some big floppy hat on. You couldn't see his eyes.
Although, to be fair, the white people in the cartoon did look like mongoloids. So
yeah, I like the sea of the same white guys. Except for one guy was not singing along, one of the white guys.
Oh, didn't watch it that much. Anyway, but TV is sort of his fixation or his...
Well, he likes to watch.
Well, the thing is, you know, if you watch something, wouldn't
he
have a little bit more...
watches without understanding?
Is that even... I mean, I guess that's possible because
he remembers what he sees. He has a very good memory, in fact, for certain things. Remember when he's talking early in the film about the stone worker that came by 20 years
earlier? Oh, and showed him porn?
Yeah, showed him a dirty porny magazine and fixed the brick wall. He remembered him very clearly. So he has an excellent memory. And he remembers the TV shows he watches. So he's not watching them without understanding.
But he just has no insight into what... how the human beings are interacting on the television, even in a sitcom or, you know, staged environment. He doesn't have any sort of insight or curiosity to human interaction.
I see that he has like a profound curiosity, but not necessarily about humans, just about the world in general. I mean, maybe that's the idea of the autism, where you don't see humans. You see humans as another thing in the world, like a bookshelf or a car or a tree. And so you don't give them the special meaning that our brains give them. You know, the thing about Chauncey, he seemed like an alien. He seems like,
well,
let's just say there was an alien that job was to come to Earth and observe it for a few decades. Just to observe it, and he had like some ability to find himself little safe niches. Or he had enough skill to find a niche and then just sit down and watch. And he had found that he really... I mean, if you're coming from another, let's just say you were an alien and you had whatever the magical powers an alien race might have that was starfaring.
I don't know.
And you wanted to just watch a society, what would you do? I mean, you could just plop yourself down in one home and watch a garden and watch some TV and listen to the radio. He just seems like that to
tons
me.
Of films that are like that. But yeah, no, he's like a, he's kind of hatched from that egg.
He's otherworldly.
Weird Washington D.C. brownstone that has fallen into decay. Late '70s economic decline.
It was a nice house, but basically it sat there while the old man died and for 30 years while collapse around it.
Right. So you get the urban blight of mid to late '70s D.C.
where there's that hip hop arrangement of the classical music. I mean, the Motown arrangement of the classical music. It's like a 10-minute scene where the amazing thing is he pauses at the front door because he hasn't left the house ever in his life. And you see,
he's not agoraphobic at all, which is weird.
No, he's not. He just doesn't know what he'll see. And once he gets out there, he's really excited. He sees the guy that's playing basketball, and he's really pumped because it's some new experience.
To be fair, DC still fucking looks like that in places. It's
burnt out cars and guys hanging out.
Oh, what a shithole.
Around a burning bin.
I once
on a couch.
I took a flight into National, which is basically right in DC. It's actually across the river in Alexandria, and
National. It's not Ronald Reagan Airport.
I fucking would never call it Ronald Reagan.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, but nobody ever calls it that.
Oh, they call it National.
I wouldn't call it that just because I hate fucking.
Well,
Ronald
hold it.
Reagan.
It's in DC. No,
that's in Alexandria, Virginia. It's like right across the river, and so I get in, and I didn't want to go out to the Beltway because the Beltway's a fucking nightmare at rush hour. Not that DC is any less of a nightmare, but I was like, okay, might as well drive through Central DC to get out. I was going up to Baltimore. And so I get across the river, and I get out onto New York Avenue, which is the streets are named. Like, there's Pennsylvania, which is obviously the president's street, and then there's New York, and so they have state names. And New York Avenue is just a shithole. It's, bars over the window. there's, old couches at bus stops. But people sitting on them aren't really waiting for a bus, And, it kind of looked like Chauncey's neighborhood there when he came outside.
Yeah.
D.C.'s a shithole, and that's not even Anacostia, which is, like, the worst. But anyway, so, yeah.
Yeah, it looked pretty bad, but I just love that change and with the funky music.
The funky music, Rose, she did see that part. She thought it was kind of depressing.
Oh, it was just great. It was 10 minutes of that great funky arrangement. Him walking around and seeing all those sights, I just found it fascinating. When he runs into the camera at the television store, and he's really confused about him being on television.
Oh, right.
I just found that really, there's something that I found really interesting about that.
Speaks to Hal Ashby's direction, cinematography.
Maybe so. I don't know about the cinematography. I think it speaks more about the performance.
Well, okay, so... obviously, like I said, this is a satire. You don't seem all that interested in the satire.
I'm not particularly interested in that part of it. I guess satire is just so dime a dozen these days.
Well, but this was,
I find the character more fascinating in the performance.
Wasn't much to his character.
I thought the way he interacted with people would be fascinating.
Well, yeah, but it was a shtick. There wasn't any depth to him. He was a stand-in for
Laurel Hardy,
the country's village idiot.
He was playing sort of the village idiot.
Well, which is basically an indictment of the United States popular culture and media culture and political
seems
culture.
Seems so trite.
That's what it's about. I mean, I could read basically what
Hal has to say about it.
Well, the
book itself.
The book, one of Kaczynski's most significant works is Being There, published in 1971, a satirical look at the unreality of America's media culture. It is a story of Chance the Gardener, a man without many defining qualities who emerges from nowhere and suddenly becomes the heir to the throne of the Wall Street tycoon and presidential policy advisor. He has simple, straightforward responses to popular concerns, are praised as visionary despite no one really understanding what he is really saying. Many questions surround his mysterious origins, and filling in the blanks in his background proves impossible.
Oh, that's sort of lame.
That's what it's about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's not what it's about to me.
What's it about to you?
It's more about the tale of a supernatural being that's sort of meandering the earth.
Well, Jesus Christ, man. Why pick this... No, that's not what it's about.
Well, maybe it's not what it's meant to be about, but that's how I see it.
There's a ton.
It's real to me, all right.
There's tons of other.
Well, maybe if we take it from that direction, I think it's absolutely pitch perfect.
From the satire point of view,
I mean, not just Hank, let this take the satire out back and throw it in a trash can with all the other trite satire we see every day. I mean, maybe you're right about being the satire being dated. Oh, the modern, there's no real substance to all the shit we see on TV. What?
No, it's not about
that. You're really blowing my mind.
No, it's the...
That everybody in charge is really that stupid? That just doesn't even make any sense. The people in power aren't like that.
Well...
They're incredible, conniving, incredibly intelligent people. And maybe they put a figurehead up that's an idiot, like George Bush too. And he's not really an idiot. He's just sort of a regular bloke.
I'll say this. It's not that
Cheney's not an idiot.
It's not
Cheney's
that they're
a calculating genius.
It's not that no. It's not that they're bumbling idiots in power. It's the fact that and when you get older and you start, you know, going through the motions of adulthood and being an adult, you realize that, you know, it's like, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? Nobody knows what the fuck they're supposed to be doing. And nobody, you keep saying Cheney's a genius, they're all geniuses. And no, they're not.
Oh, I bet those guys high up are pretty smart.
I wouldn't say they're any smarter than somebody who has the confidence to go into a situation headlong and pretend they know what the fuck they're doing.
Well, pretending is an important part of it, yeah.
That's the most important part.
Yeah, you got to pretend to a certain extent.
Nobody trains you.
I'm believing that.
Nobody. There's
I've never
no
been in the echelons of power.
There's no.
I'm sure there's some pretty good people.
Presidential there. Training university. There's no CEO training university. It's just shit that you start doing. People
well,
around you.
Managerial skills. You know how to task.
Well, there's. I mean,
and
I'm
you
not
know how
saying
to
that
people to know what their skills are, so you can put teams together.
There's no fundamental skills, but there isn't anything that. You just can't learn by doing or just doing it. And so what you get here is Chansey, who knows nothing about anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have these people in power, like the president, who are reaching for somebody who seems like they know what they're talking about and latching onto
it. Looking for some guidance.
And guidance. And he's the president of the United States. Well, then fuck, he knows what he's doing. He is surrounded by advisors.
He comes over to the guy that swings the big dick around the country with all his money and business. He comes to him for advice, and that guy vouches for chance.
Yeah.
So he sort of has to take the advice of Chance.
All right.
The respectability of Ben is sort of transferred over.
Well, let's
Chance.
Look at a current example. Look at the monkey house that we call Congress. Do you think those people know what the fuck they're doing at all?
No, they're everybody's looking out for their constituency's best interest, or maybe their own personal best interest.
There you go.
Sort of a mix of the two.
They don't know what the fuck
they're
doing.
That's how it's designed to work.
And they don't give a shit.
I mean, what do you mean? They give a shit about their own and their constituency's
best interest.
They give
a shit about doing their job as it's outlined in the Constitution.
I mean, what is their job other than not representing their constituents?
They're not representing their constituents, and that's the problem.
Well, you don't think bringing pork back to your district is representing your constituency?
Maybe as a senator, but not a congressman. That's not what they do.
I mean,
they go out there,
their party.
They go out there, and they, you know, if you're a Republican, go out there and you jerk off the gun nuts and the anti-abortionists and the God-fearing.
Oh, so you're saying they're representing
folks.
Their party?
Well, they're actually all of them are representing
and they,
moneyed
they got
interests.
A plurality of the votes in their district, so they're at least representing the interests of a plurality in some sort of weird compromise. Like I compromise when I vote for the Dems.
They're representing their moneyed interests. They're not representing a constituency.
All right. Well, they're representing moneyed interests in their constituency.
And when you're representing moneyed constituencies in Congress, you don't really have to know what the fuck you're doing. You just have to serve those interests.
Of course not, because that's what we see them just rubber stamping companies write legislation. And that just gets stuff. You know, you hear these all the time of these recommendations, these documents that companies and consortiums put out. And then they basically get copied and pasted in
exactly
the law.
So it's a pretty fucking easy job, and the people that are in Congress are basically it's monkey house.
It's a lot
shit.
Of stroking. You gotta and stroke people like crazy. You gotta take them upstairs and have them watch.
You mentioned George W. Bush, and if that isn't a village idiot, I don't know who. I mean,
I'm sure he's as smart as you or I.
Insightful. They're smart. What do you mean by smart? Smart is a rainbow of qualities.
I mean, I think he can judge situations and just look at how things are and understand them.
I've met smart kids smart kids. You know, they scored high on their SATs, brilliant geniuses. Oh. And then they turned out to be dope smoking do-nothings the whole life.
We just got done with the Jeopardy teen tournament. I don't know if you watch it.
No,
Gene and I watch Jeopardy. We record it and then we watch a couple nights a week. This had the teen tournament. And these are all high school kids. The final three kids is like a second or third generation Indian kid. He's 14. He's got huge ears. He's really smart. You know, he's always wearing this suit and he's got a big smile. Then there's like a 17-year-old kid who has a huge white smile. He looks like he's straight out of the 50s. Yeah, close cropped hair. He said he wants to be president someday.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the real low voice and he always goes, "Yes, sir. Yes, Mr." Last guy is like a groovy black guy with a big fro.
Nice. Did he win?
You know, I haven't watched the last one, but the fro guy was in last place. It was a sum 2 day. The little second or third generation Indian kid was in first, and Mr. Future President of the United States was in second.
Anyway, I'm just saying that there's smart, and then there's smart to me doesn't mean anything. You have to categorize it through some kind of.
Well, I mean, we're talking in generalities here. I mean.
Well, I'm talking like about D.C., where this movie takes place, and the people that are in D.C. and have achieved power. They're not rocket scientists. I mean, you've heard some of these people on the science advisory panel, you know, committees, you know, talking about fucking Jesus running around with dinosaurs and all kinds of crazy bullshit. That's insane idiocy. Those people are morons at a certain level.
I mean, boy, I'm not saying I got a terrible view of humanity, and I think.
Fucking Senator Ted Stevens thought there was like tubes of information that made up the internet.
An old fucking 80-year-old guy. You ever talk to old 80-year-old guys? Like, man, their view of the world has been set in concrete since they were 60.
All right. Well, okay.
The guy's not going to. You have hardly any brain plasticity left at that point. What do you expect an 85-year-old guy from Alaska to say?
He's just a lots of mean racist shit. Is kind of what.
Yeah, you would hope.
All right.
But look, back to the movie. I mean, it's sort of implausible to. I mean, that's it. That's really the satire, is that they believe a guy spouting nonsense. That's it.
They're so
dumb that they'll grab onto anything because it comes from the hand of power. Just because Chance has sat there on Ben's hand. That's why Ben lifts him up and says, "Here's a seer." You know, here's the eye of wisdom. Listen to what he says. And everybody goes, all right.
Wouldn't you?
Wouldn't?
I mean, that's the other
thing.
People
wouldn't do it. It's absolutely absurd. The scenes that take place in this movie, they're absurd.
People don't behave.
I'm not. What I do, I'm arguing my point that Chance is a supernatural being.
That's just charming people supernaturally?
That he just has a preternatural understanding of the universe.
I don't think he has an understanding of anything.
Okay, I'm going to go down this road whether you like it or not.
This is another broken clock right twice a day kind of thing. All right.
So here, this is what made me think about a Philip K. Dick
Mark's
story.
Mark's got a quote from the Philip K. Dick
reader. This is the short story, The Golden Man.
That there was a movie, wasn't it, based at Nicolas Cage played in it.
Oh, well, I didn't see a thing.
I don't know what it's called.
There's a... The short story basically is that we're living in a world in the near future where we're getting all sorts of weird human mutants. And of course, there's all sorts of people are scared of them and they have a...
That's right, like the X-Men.
Yeah, they show them. It's like it's sort of like the X-Men, except the really weird mutations.
Okay.
Anyways, there's this one mutation that comes up and this Adonis figure of a man covered in like golden fur, just a beautiful man.
Oh.
And, he's captured by this organization that basically kills these people. And there's a short bit of the story where you're actually in the mind of the Adonis figure.
Okay.
And he says, he couldn't be surprised. The element didn't exist for him. The positions of things, the space relationships of all matter in the immediate future were as certain for him as his own body. The only thing that was unknown was that which had already passed out of being. In a vague, dim fashion, he occasionally wondered where things went after he passed them.
Okay.
I mean, the thing is that there's this character that's basically he's an animal. He the golden man. He sees the future and thus makes his choices based off the future, but he doesn't, there's no real thought other than the path that Lisu is surviving. So he doesn't have to use his intellect to predict the future. He just knows what it is.
Okay.
And so he sees all the paths, and he picks the path that benefits him in a very simple way. Him not being dead, him being fed, and him being free. And so sort of from almost like a simplistic animalistic nature, given this power of knowing the future, he can manipulate the world in amazing ways. Basically, right. We see him as having a wonderful predictive powers, even though it's very simple. It's just imagine if you live 15 minutes in the past or a few days in the past and you saw to this present time how different your life would be and how little you'd have to think necessarily. If you could just see everything, you wouldn't have to know how to talk. You would just know what sounds to make in order to get what you wanted out of life with no understanding whatsoever of what you were doing.
So you're saying that chance is...
I'm just saying I see something of chance in the Golden Man.
That he sees human beings as plants.
You don't like it because it's not the interpretation that's meant by the...
No. I'm trying to get your point. I'm trying to find out he thinks differently.
He's otherworldly. And the way that he's supernatural, it's almost... It made me think the idea that, especially this story in this movie, made the idea that omniscience doesn't necessarily mean understanding. It just means knowing.
Well, let's take...
And there's a difference between knowing and understanding. Let's say Chauncey knows everything. And so he's lazy. And so basically he does the minimum he needs to get what he wants out of life, which is just some place that's safe and comfortable where you can sit and watch.
So
he just manipulates the world because he knows. He has a certain level of omniscience. And he just does the absolute minimum to get what he wants out of life. You see how lazy Chauncey is, how little he speaks. And how he doesn't seem to understand anything. I'm just wondering, he seems like... Just imagine if God knew everything but understood nothing.
Let's take another half-retard movie, Rain Man, where you got a television-watching autistic dude.
Yeah.
His superpower is counting cards. He has... I mean, that's an autistic thing.
Yeah.
Is these sort of preternatural abilities.
Yeah, but what does he do? What does he do that's so unrealistic as in this film? All the situations that Chance gets in this film are absurd.
Well, he gets
what happens in Rain Man that's so absurd?
Nothing.
Well, that's the difference.
Well, No. The absurdity is his namesake, Chance. I mean, the chance that he would be hit by the richest woman and richest couple in the world or in the country and be taken in by them and be welcomed into a lifestyle he is accustomed is...
And a beautiful garden. He loves the garden. Well, he's in probably the most gorgeous private garden. He basically has the most... After the end, after all this took place, he basically has full access to the nicest private garden.
That's the most supernatural element of this film. In reality, what happens would be he would wander around crazy until somebody took advantage of him.
Or he was institutionalized.
And then the cops would, grab him, put him in an institution, and then he would be sitting there on medication, watching the TV in the corner of the caged room with all the other people.
That's what I'm saying. This movie pushes it beyond satire. It breaks it near the end. It pushes these situations so far, it's absurd. And then at the end, it pushes it to obvious absurdity with him walking on water.
Well, if that part wasn't in there, Hal Ashby decided just to get rid of that and put put in just some ending. I think that was actually in one cut where he just kind of
walked around.
That was it.
Yeah.
Would it have left that image in your head?
I don't think it would have been as clear. I might have come to that idea, but it wouldn't have been cemented in the end like it was, but with that ending of the film. I mean, it makes everything make sense.
That
it explains everything that happens without the sort of dime store satire.
Well, there's a spell over everybody around him.
He basically weaves a spell.
Yeah, no, but it's not him weaving the spell. It's the film. It's the satirical element of the film that's doing that. It's not the character. The character is two dimensional. There's no third dimension to him.
Mm.
He doesn't have any.
He's not supernatural.
It's as supernatural as the film is a satire. I mean, it's an exaggeration of the truth. That's what satire is.
Yeah.
Whether it's the characters in it or the people around
it. Just doesn't seem to be. I don't buy what the satire is telling me. All right. I guess
that's why this movie.
I guess I wouldn't enjoy it if that's my interpretation. I wouldn't think it that great of a film.
then why?
Well, other than the fact, other than the tension, I love the tension. That was more that happened during the film.
But then why set the film in this sort of DC power politics environment?
It wouldn't have to be. It could be set anywhere.
They didn't do that because they're trying to make, Kaczynski was trying to make a point.
I don't know. It seems like sort of a lame point. Doesn't it seem sort of lame?
It seems dated is what it seems like. And that's my problem with the film.
Well,
and my problem with the film is that if we're criticizing media culture of 1979, we got like 34 years under our belt of criticism that's worse. I mean, you know, I watch the news I watch the news in the
morning. There's nothing on the news.
Exactly. And you know what? You know how I figure that out? Is when they're showing me a fucking YouTube video of a pig. Like, and I'm like, this isn't news. This is, I could go click on this shit on YouTube.
You know, I think something happened. I don't think either of us know what's going on in the world any longer.
I do, but I don't, I stopped caring, sadly.
Maybe that's just
because my cynicism
older.
Overtook me.
Yeah, I guess that's it.
No, I read enough of the world and I read enough sources to get the facts.
Oh, God, did you hear what happened to Kim Kardashian the other day?
Hopefully, like, she was killed by a bus. Her head got
her and her boyfriend got in an argument.
Yeah, see,
they can't figure out what last name to give their child. Isn't that terrible?
That's not what this film is. This film is criticizing like meat and potatoes, straight, you know, media culture.
There's something here called newspapers. I'm not familiar with them.
Well, I mean, you know, we live in our news is so absurd. Our culture is so absurd. That I would say this film is almost sentimental in its look at criticizing.
It is a little bit. It's sort of sweet.
It's quaint.
Yeah, it is a little.
I mean,
quaint.
if they think
I sort of like it again.
Television is a cesspool in 1979, then they're in for a shocker now.
You know, I'm coming around to the film from your point of view now. I think I sort of like it from that direction.
Of being a a kind of a dated critique
sort
of,
look what they thought were bad problems.
Back then. They just thought, you know, like the morality was.
They didn't experience the trumped up second Gulf War. I'm still dumbfounded.
They
by
did
that
have
war.
The Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Vietnam. I mean, the shit's played out the same way, but it's just the bullshit level has gone up really high now, and I don't know how you would write being there now. I don't know what you would do.
All right. So let's take these two interpretations and can we put them both to bed?
Good night. All right. So
there's one thing I do want to talk about.
All right.
And some of the really...
Shirley MacLaine being kind of hot back then?
Oh, man. When she was in that that sort of peach-covered nightie.
Did you ever see...
Love to just suck on those little titties.
Wow, man.
I'll tell you. She looked pretty hot.
Candor there. Did you ever see the Clint Eastwood Western? Was it Three Mules for Sister Sarah?
No, I haven't seen that.
She's in that playing a nun. Nun who's actually a prostitute, but...
my favorite kind of nun.
She's hot. I don't know how old she was, but she was in her prime. She's like, you know, hot little
great
redhead.
Lips.
Hot Whoa. Redhead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They call that fire crotch. I learned that from Zach Galifianakis.
Kids don't know what fire crotch means anymore. That's not.
It means when you don't shave your pubes, they're red.
What?
You get a red 5 o'clock shadow around your hoo-ha.
My grandparents. Wow, that's bad sequitur. My grandparents lived just down the road from Shirley MacLaine. Shirley MacLaine had a house in Yelm or Graham, Washington.
Really? No.
She was into the Jay-Z Knight thing when that shit was going on.
Jay-Z, is that that rapper guy?
Ramtha.
Oh, Ramtha's still around, isn't she? Or Ramtha's the heat.
It's a 50,000-year-old warrior channeled through Jay-Z Knight.
But the woman who channels Ramtha.
Jay-Z Knight.
Oh, that's her name? Jay-Z?
Jay-Z.
Like the rapper? Is she named after him?
Yeah, I guess it is kind of. No. No, this was like back in the 80s.
She's still around, though. Because wasn't there a controversy in the last election? Because Jay-Z gave some money to the Democratic National Committee?
You're talking about Jay-Z the rapper? Or
no,
Jay-Z Knight?
Jay-Z B. Smooth. I mean, Jay-Z Knight.
That is like a rapper name, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's sweet.
No, this is the New Age freak
show. My name
show.
Is Ramtha, and I like to say, I like to talk about old stuff in a rap kind of way.
The cult, like a cult leader or something. And Shirley MacLaine was into that, I guess. So she had
I hear something. Yeah, there was some movie about that stuff, right?
I don't know.
Like don't something, know. Something, something, something.
So,
I don't know. So what
wait, no, hold on. So my grandparents were like building a hot tub addition back when you built those in the 80s. And they and Shirley MacLaine,
they were swingers then, right?
Shirley MacLaine was doing a remodel, and they actually got this big smoke glass window from Shirley MacLaine's house, and it was in my grandparents' house. I was like, that's Shirley MacLaine's window.
Oh.
So my parents used to
still
tell
alive.
Me. She is.
Yeah.
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 I haven't seen her lately. Waiting for Terms of Endearment 2 to come out. All right. What are you going
to
say?
So I was just going to say, okay, so putting all the meaning of the film to bed. Some of the parts of the some of the writing and some of the situations that I thought just were so well played, and I guess maybe it's a screenplay. So I just want to play a couple of clips of interactions people have earlier in the film with Chance.
Okay,
I just find they tickle me.
All right.
So here's one where he's on an elevator with one of the manservants at Ben's house.
I've never been in one of these before.
It's one of Mr. Rand's, since he's been ill.
I see. Does it have a television?
No. But Mr. Rand does have one with an electric motor. That way he can get around by himself.
How long do we stay in here?
How long? I don't know. We'll see what the doctor says.
The thing is so amazing about that interaction. I don't know if you'll remember that scene.
Yeah, no.
But they're both on a boat. For the whole scene, they're on a separate page. These two characters are having two different conversations simultaneously with each other.
Yeah.
I mean, they never talk about everything they talk about is something different than what the other person interprets.
And right.
I just think that. I mean, they talk about. I've never been in one of these, and. He's talking about Chance is talking about an elevator, and the butler is talking about the wheelchair. And then, you know, he talks about, does they have a TV? And the butler goes, TV on a wheelchair.
Well, yeah. It's
but Chance is thinking a TV in this room.
Well, anytime you take the literal and you juxtapose it with the figurative, you get that comic effect.
But what they do is they use that over and over and over again in this film. And I just really enjoy it. It just tickled me. And the other thing is the incredible naivete of the Chance character.
Well, of course, he's designed to be that way.
Here's him saying something to a doctor. There's a physician. It's the only person that has insight in this entire film.
Yeah.
The doctor. And in the end, he decides to keep his mouth shut for the best of everybody. But here, this is something he tells this physician.
He's gone, Chauncey. Yes, I know, Robert. I've seen this before. It happens to old people.
He tells a physician that they're hanging over Ben's body. He just died. And he tells the physician, yes, I've seen this before. It happens to old people. They He's saying that to a physician. It just fucking cracks me up. It fucking cracks me up.
You know, it's interesting that physician played by, I think, Richard Dysart.
Oh, yeah, from the... Thing.
He's from The Thing, and there's also another guy from The Thing.
Oh, really?
The lawyer.
Oh,
yeah.
The skinny lawyer that's going out on his wife with his coworker.
Yeah.
I love it when they first come to the old man's house, they say they're going to visit the bedroom first because they're going to give the property a once-over. Just as they're walking the dog, they're walking in the door before they see Chance there.
Yeah. All right. So
let's go. Let's hit Ebert up and see what he had to say. All right. Well, Ebert reviewed this movie back in 1980. He gave it 4 stars, and he doesn't go any higher than 4, does he?
That's his tops.
Let me read a few excerpts from it, and then the final paragraph in its entirety. You know, he compliments the film quite a bit in this review, but he doesn't really draw any conclusions, which I'm starting to think is maybe the best way to enjoy this film.
Yeah, it seems like you definitely went.
I mean, I sort of went out on a limb there. That's the name of the Shirley MacLaine movie, Out on a Limb.
Really?
Yeah, it's something about her being
Right, her metaphysical experience. Stuff, yeah, Out on a Limb. Oh, we should review that.
maybe not.
Maybe in a dark day 20 years from now.
So, He says the movie begins with a cockamamie notion. It's basically one joke told for 2 hours.
And maybe that was my problem, but anyway.
Yeah, I don't blame you. and it requires Peter Sellers to maintain an excruciatingly narrow tone of behavior in a role that has him on screen almost constantly.
It was almost like mime.
I love that one joke for 2 hours.
It was kind of like a mime performance.
Yeah, it was almost like a vaudeville act.
Yeah.
He says, he talks a little bit about the setup to the story, but he says something about to describe the character of Chance. He says he's watched countless hours of television and he can be pleasant, smile, shake hands, and comport himself. He learned that from watching all those guests on talk shows. That's really his great skill.
Oh, the people that come out and say hello.
He can always say yes and thank you. That's wonderful. And shake hands and look in people's eyes and smile.
Yeah, he has the veneer of empathy.
Yeah, you just take that idea of the talk show behavior and take any of the understanding out from underneath it. And it's just the behavior.
The social niceties.
Yeah, but it gets him by.
Yeah, it's pantomime.
He's pantomiming it, isn't he? Because you see him pantomiming other things in the movie all the time. Well, like he's always, when he sees people exercise or doing yoga, he starts doing those things immediately.
Well, you know, and it's like you said. I mean, if you want to go with the alien analogy,
it's not a very good analogy.
Well, I don't know, but maybe
thanks a lot.
Show up in a foreign culture.
It just seems so foreign to me.
Well, like a foreign culture, you will pantomime custom, even though you don't really know what it
means.
But
at least we try to put some sort of understanding structure underneath it, and Chance can't.
No,
it's really just the pantomime. That's all there is.
Right.
And he can remember the pantomimes, but he can't understand them. Anyways, this is a one joke premise.
Yeah, one joke.
The whole movie has to be tailored to a narrow range within Sellers. Gardner can think, behave, speak, and make choices. It's really,
he's literally the mime in the box. You know, he can only act within that box.
And the whole movie is I think the movie seems so delicate, like a house of cards.
Right? Yeah,
it really is a house of cards. They just keep building and building. Oh my God, when's it going to fall down?
And it never does.
And I think that's the thing that really sort of wrung me out watching this film. He says there's wonderful comic moments, but they're never pushed too far to strain the story's premise. I think that's wrong.
Yeah, there's no slapstick. I mean, maybe that's what he means.
Some of this stuff is really,
yeah, it's really out of control.
It gets NOS. And he says, Without any analysis, he says this one line. The movie also has an audacious closing shot that moves the film's whole metaphor into a brand new philosophical arena.
He's
saying a lot by saying nothing.
I dismiss that. I dismiss that end part. I think it was just a little nice serif at the end of the. It was just embellishment.
I'm still confused about that.
I wouldn't be.
All right, man.
I think it's like more art.
I got more of the magical thinking than you do. So. Let me read this whole goddamn left paragraph.
Okay.
So it basically sums everything up. What is Being There about? I have reviews calling it an indictment of television. But that doesn't fit. Sellers wasn't warped by television. He was retarded to begin with and has TV to thank for what abilities he has to move through society, which he's
yeah, it's like Daryl Hannah in Splash when she...
He says, is it an indictment? Yeah. Is it an indictment of society for being so dumb as to accept the Sellers character as a great philosophical sage? Maybe. But that's not so fascinating either. And I have to agree with him there. I'm not really inclined to plumb the movie for its message. Although I'm sure it'll be a favorite audience sport.
Yeah, just like the last hour here.
Yeah, he just admires it for having the guts to take this totally weird conceit and push it to its ultimate comic conclusion.
Well, you know, the thing,
to take one joke.
Right. And maybe that's part of my problem, is because I know that Jerzy Kosinski was intimately related. Obviously he wrote the novel, not for a future Peter Sellers comic act to be performed,
but to be an indictment.
I mean, that's why you write a novel. You don't write novels because of some kind of, you know, social experiment. You're making a point. He's making a point. And
I'm not a big fan of the point. Neither is Ebert.
And I'm not really either, because for starters, it's dated.
And it's sort of, yeah, it's
and
sort of
it's well trod, yeah. And there's nothing here that we don't know or don't have any insight into. I do.
Even though we're powerless to change it.
I do kind of like to be reminded that it's sort of, you know, the idiot's rule and all that kind of thing.
I just watched Piers Morgan and I'm reminded.
Well, and how far you can get in being sharply dressed and pretending to know what you're talking about.
Again, I just watch Piers Morgan.
Exactly. So on that level, it was, yeah, but I just, it's kind of, no pun intended, been there, done
then,
that.
Then really the great pleasure is the joke, the gag, and how well it's performed. Well, I took a lot of pleasure
maybe,
in
and maybe that was kind of my problem.
I don't think you did take as much pleasure
and
in it.
And I think it was because it was too farcical. I think that it was too... nobody around Chauncey would fall under that spell for very long.
Yeah.
And that's my problem. It's like, oh, come on. You would ask him a few more questions, and then you'd get like, he'd be like a broken record.
Fall down.
He'd be like a broken record.
That's so much where so much of the tension comes from.
And he'd be like, hey, you know, this guy is... cuckoo, you know, you'd like do a little spin around your head and you're like, he's a little nutty, you know, and then
I think you're right, but that's where a lot of the tension comes from too.
But Peter Sellers' performance, I guess, is, you know,
one thing we can both agree on is Chance is the second coming of Jesus Christ.
I totally agree.
So
I think you're
more of the Jesus Christ was a false prophet.
I'm a little bit more of the Judeo of the Judeo-Christian, you know. Yeah.
So you're not up for the new Pope position?
Oh, yeah, no. I'm not gay enough, for starters. I see like a waxed Brazilian dancing Pope for the, you know.
Oh, a lady
just,
Pope.
Just, no, 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 no. Just a flaming, just flamboyant.
Have you ever had
Mardi
sex
Gras.
With a man?
Yeah. No, but I like to watch.
Ooh, I'll go get Warren.
Yeah, all right. So have we,
I think we plumbed the depths as much as we should.
Have we been there, done that?
Right. What the hell?
I don't know. I'm trying to, you know, whatever. I already used that.
Yeah,
one.
No, that was a fun discussion. I think I learned a lot. I learned a little bit about myself and everyone else.
Good. All right. Now is the time on Mr. Rogers. We're okay.
Well, I don't know. What are we doing next week?
We're going to do a Herzog movie because we haven't done a Herzog movie, and Herzog is he's one of those great directors that does almost half documentaries, half, I guess, fictional films, maybe more documentaries. I don't know.
Later in his career, he's done a lot of docs.
But he's fascinated with jungles. There's a ton of jungles in his movies, and he's fascinating with torturing people in those jungles, whether it's the actor or the characters or both.
And being tortured in turn by those actors.
And then having those actors torture him. So
And monkeys.
And so there's a lot of Herzog movies that fit under that category. But we're going to do Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Oh, man, that is a crazy movie.
With crazy fucking, who's the actor?
Oh, I forget his name.
No, we can't forget his name. It's
Klaus Kinski.
Klaus Kinski.
I know. I was yesterday. I was sort of browsing through the film. I got the DVD, just seeing some of the points, and I was like, "Oh man, this is one crazy goddamn movie."
The Wrath of God. There's a lot of fun colonial historical context to discuss.
But if you listen to this podcast, you really should watch the films.
I'm assuming that. I don't know what people are doing.
Well, you know what I do with other podcasts, and I don't know what our listeners do, is I have a few movie review podcasts that are similar to this. You know, some of them are better than others. But I usually just listen to the episodes where they talk about movies I've watched, which sort of makes it annoying when some shows like to talk about three movies at a time.
Yeah, I don't like those. I like one movie at a time.
How do they have so much time every week to watch? They find some sort of thread, or at least they try to make
a
spread between three movies.
We're too lazy.
I mean, to seriously think. I mean, this movie basically took up my entire yesterday after work because I watched it
about,
when I got home, and then my mind was tripping for the rest of the night.
Well, I thought about doing two movie podcasts for us, but they're very specific, like Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2, maybe for Quentin Tarantino, and or maybe Linkletter's Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, because they're kind of companion films. They're not. There's not like a thread. They're kind of really tight-knit sequels.
Yeah, I can understand that.
But, yeah, no, I that seems like a lot of work.
A lot of movie podcasts do that. But a lot of times they mix in what's in theaters now as well.
Oh.
Which I don't like because when you go back and listen to them, they spend 20 minutes talking about movies I don't see. I don't see that many movies.
Well, I like podcasts that address a subject, and that's it. I don't like to hear the 15 minutes of... you know, what I did today and what I'm doing tonight, which, you know, it's fine. There's a lot of podcasts that do that. I don't know. There's a lot of, like, we do show news here. And show news is usually cut down to about 30 seconds, and then we move on to
because
the movie.
There's no show news. That's the joke.
Yeah. And I just like kind of one topic, like Luke Burge's sci-fi book review.
Yeah, he gets down to business.
He just does that one book, and that's what he talks about, and he adds some anecdotes. But I don't want to deviate the topic. I don't like switching topics.
It seems like it'd make a lot of work.
Camp out. And plus, the way our podcast is listed, it has the movies, so if you don't want to watch, if you don't want to listen to the podcast about a movie you
haven't
seen,
listen to it.
And you just move on to the next movie.
I don't recommend listening to it if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the way it rolls.
Seems like it'd be a waste of your time.
You know, we never get any negative criticism other than that one Portuguese or that Brazilian lady who commented on our Caligula podcast.
Was it Portuguese or Brazilian?
I think it was Portuguese.
I mean, it was in Portuguese, but it was from Brazil.
She just called this to...
probably Brazil. If you're going to play the numbers game, it would probably be Brazil.
I did translate her comment. It was like something like, what are these two beasts just talking about or something? You and me. She was expecting the movie, but sorry. Anyway.
Yeah, that's the way it goes, man.
We disappoint. But next week, it's going to be full-on colonial, Spanish colonial Amazonian craziness. It's a good movie. So until next week...
Yes, I understand.
Somebody at the door. See who that special person is.